Once again, my name is Eric, and I'm still an addict. At this time, I would like to introduce our first speaker to share on the topic of the history of Narcotics Anonymous. And without further ado, I give you Danny from the Bucks County area.
Hi, everybody. Recovering addict named Danny. Hi. I've been preparing for this for 25 years. Actually, I just got done golf, and I ran up here. I didn't hit him good, as usual. I didn't hit him straight, but I hit him. All right, the first thing to do with recovery in Narcotics Anonymous was actually before Narcotics Anonymous started. There was a guy named Houston Sewell, and he was an engineer, and he was building streets, and he got transferred to Kentucky. And he went there, and he had an AA home group. He was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was going to Lexington, Kentucky, where the Narco Farm was. The Narco Farm was a prison where you could either go yourself as a drug addict, or you could go as a prisoner. If you were a drug addict prisoner, they sent you to this place called Narco Farm. And he was bringing in AA, and people were getting sober, and they were staying sober. But he ran into this guy, Harry, who would stay sober and not use alcohol, but he kept relapsing on drugs. So he went to the guy who ran the place. His name was Victor Vogel, and he asked Victor Vogel if he could start a thing for drug addicts. And this was February 17th, 1947, and they started a meeting. It was called Addicts Anonymous. And Addicts Anonymous went on into the 60s, and what they did, the prisoners had wrote a little magazine book, and when you graduated there, they would mail the book to you because you would leave your address. And they were sending these books all over. And this guy, Daniel Carlton, he was a Puerto Rican guy from Hamada, Puerto Rico, and he was in there seven times, and he heard about this Addicts Anonymous, and he had a spiritual awakening in his cell. And when he got out, he went to New York City, and he hooked up with a woman named Brigadier Dorothy Berry, who worked at the Salvation Army, and she was helping addict women in the Women's House of Detention in Manhattan in Greenwich Village. And he hooked up with her, and he went and started the first Narcotics Anonymous meeting in 1948 in New York. He named it Narcotics Anonymous because AA Addicts Anonymous infringed on the initials AA Alcoholics Anonymous. So, and back then they also called it narcotics, all the drugs that were called narcotics, so that's where he came up with Narcotics Anonymous. So he's hooked up with this woman, and he's going, and he relapses again and goes back to the Narco Farm for his eighth stay. And when he gets released, he goes back to New York and starts Narcotics Anonymous over again. And this Brigadier Dorothy Berry lends him her office for the Salvation Army. He was a pauper. He was an addict that was in and out of jail, so he didn't have any money. So he used their phone as the NA hotline, but there was no NA hotline at the time. And he started meetings, and it wasn't a fellowship. What they did was they started chapters, and these chapters moved to California, to New Jersey, New York, Philadelphia, and they were chapters. There was no fellowship at this time. They didn't know what fellowship was. There was no traditions. And they wrote this piece of literature called Our Way of Life. And it had 12 steps on it, but they used the word drugs instead of addiction. So he started these chapters, and he died in August of 1956. And he died of cancer, and he refused to take any kind of medication because he wanted to go out clean. And he got buried in Flushing, New York cemetery as a pauper, and the Salvation Army buried him, and they never gave him a headstone. And I'll get back to that. A woman, another Puerto Rican woman named Ray Lopez, she took over where Daniel Carlson left, and she got a big job with the city. So she was involved in Narcotics Anonymous minimally, but what she did was she wrote letters to all the prisons and got them to start Narcotics Anonymous. They actually started one in Michigan and several other prisons. And anything that I'm saying, we got proof of all this stuff. So it's not like, you know, I made this stuff up. Like I said, I've been preparing this for this 25 years. So I've been reading it and writing it. And so what happened was Ray Lopez took over, but she got real busy. And they had no funds. So what they did was they got civil-minded people. And what the civil-minded people were doctors, lawyers, and normal people who weren't addicts. And the reason why they got them is because they came up with NACON, National Advisory Council on Narcotics. And what they did was these civil-minded people helped raise funds, because as soon as you heard drug addict, nobody would give any money because they thought they were going to be using it for drugs. You know, when you think of a drug addict, you think of, you know, a guy with toes sticking out of his feet laying by the curb and a bum and all that stuff. Again, there was no seventh tradition being passed around in any of the meetings because they didn't have traditions. They didn't know, but this is how they try to raise funds. February 2nd, 1950, Jimmy Kinnon comes to Alcoholics Anonymous and gets sober in AA. And he knew he was different, but I got to back up because I wanted to tell you, Jimmy Kinnon is from Scotland, and he came over into the United States, and he wound up moving to Philadelphia. He came to Ellis Island, and from Ellis Island, he went to Philadelphia, and he stayed in the Tacony section of Philadelphia. He lived on Longshore Street, and he actually was a bartender, Jimmy Kinnon, and he met his first wife, Agnes, while he was riding his bike back and forth from work to the bar back to his house, and he married her. And they had kids, and he had a dream to move to California, and he moved to California, and when he moved there, he moved into a boarding home in California, and he wound up buying his own house on Sherman Way, and that's when, you know, he was an addict, but there was no Narcotics Anonymous in California, so he got sober in AA, like I said, February 2nd, 1950. So he felt weird. He felt different in there. And he would sit in the back rooms, and he would talk to other addicts thinking, you know, what are we going to do? And one thing that I didn't mention, when he was in Scotland, he was interested in the town drunk. The town drunk was this sloppy old alcoholic, and he would go try to help him all the time. And he would go and pick him up, and, he, you know, he would take him over to the church and get him fed and stuff like that. So it was in his blood to help addicts and stuff. So he was interested in getting a Narcotics Anonymous meeting, but the funny thing is he didn't even start the first Narcotics Anonymous meeting in California. There was an alcoholic named Jack Prose. He used to do H&I meetings in for Alcoholics Anonymous. And a sheriff came up to him and asked him if he would start a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. Now, we don't have any proof how that sheriff knew about Narcotics Anonymous, but what we assume is that he worked in New York at one time as a sheriff there, but transferred to California. That's what I assume anyway. But he specifically asked this guy, Jack. He said, there's a lot of addicts in Hollywood, California. Can you start a Narcotics Anonymous meeting? So this guy was an alcoholic. He didn't know. So he started the first meeting, and a guy named Cy Malice came to that very first meeting. He was the first addict in that meeting. And Cy Malice happened to be a pitcher for the Philadelphia Phillies. He only played two-thirds of an inning. He never even completed one inning. And he went to Croydon. He went to a school in Croydon, the Cy Malice. But here's the thing. He was in the service, and he got injured. So he was on medication. And Jimmy Kinnon came to the third Narcotics Anonymous meeting in California. And this guy, Sal, felt he was the founder of Narcotics Anonymous since he was the first addict. Now, what happened with Jack was he would see these addicts in there nodding, and he didn't understand. And he'd be asking questions like, why are these guys always going like this? You know, nodding out. He didn't understand it. And what they were doing was they were doing dope, and they were nodding. So he said, I can't relate to any of this stuff, and he left. And Cy Malice had the keys. And Cy Malice had the keys up until like 19—this is all happening in 1952. And 53, the bylaws were written. And 56 is when Cy Malice turned the keys over. Now, Cy Malice was also an actor. He was on, what the hell was the one? Perry Mason. He was an actor on Perry Mason's show. And he got an assignment and had to leave. Now, here's what I believe, that Jimmy Kinnon didn't think he was clean because he was on medication that he was prescribed by the doctor because he was in the service and got injured. So I think Jimmy and Cy butted heads and all. So anyway, Narcotics Anonymous was in and out of happening and not happening. In 1959, it folded completely, Narcotics Anonymous. The one meeting there was at Schreier's Dryer, and it closed because there was no traditions. And people got together, Jimmy and these two women, Penny, I forget her last name right now, but this girl Penny was involved in helping start it again. But Jimmy Kinnon insisted on the traditions. He said, we got to follow the AA traditions. We'll change them to NA traditions. And since 1959, there's been an ongoing Narcotics Anonymous meeting as we know it today. And he had a vision. And what the vision was we were going to have a fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous. And he said we're going to have a worldwide fellowship as we do today. There's like 140 68,000 meetings, and we're in over 140 different countries. So Jimmy's dream came true. An interesting thing with Jimmy was that his first wife died, and his brother was married to a woman named Betty Best. And his brother got divorced from Betty, and Jimmy married his brother's wife. And there was two kids. One kid was Jimmy Kinnon and Agnes Kinnon's daughter named Kathy, and then his brother Bill had a with Betty, a daughter named Kathy. So there's actually two Kathy Kinnons. Yeah. I know that because I got one of them Jerry Springer stories, too, in my life.
Yes, you do, Dan.
And I'm not kidding you. I'll just tell you that real quick because it's pretty funny. My dad's name was Nick. His second wife was 2 years younger than me. They had a kid. The second kid we learned was my brother's because he was banging her on the side. And then when my dad died, she married my brother. So she went from my stepmother to my sister-in-law overnight. And that's a true story. So that's why I know the Freakazoid Jimmy Kinnon story, because I was interested in it, because I could relate. And I got some personal friends in here that know that that's true. Jimmy loved helping addicts, man. That was his passion. And, you know, he himself always said he was the co-founder. Now, what they got from the New York Narcotics Anonymous, okay, was they used the purpose, okay? The purpose is a thing that was written in New York, and Jimmy used it. The other thing was they used the name Narcotics Anonymous. Jimmy also was in touch with New York and asked them, this is Daniel Carlson had already died, and they asked the people if they wanted to join their Narcotics Anonymous, and they said no. So that Narcotics Anonymous in New York also went to Cleveland, Ohio, and how that happened was there was another captain in Cleveland that was taught by Brigadier Dorothy Berry when she was doing her thing in New York with the Salvation Army, And he remembered that she mentioned Narcotics Anonymous. And what was happening in Cleveland was a lot of people that were playing musical instruments came there. And they were addicts. And he wanted to help them. So he wrote to Brigadier Dorothy Berry. I got a couple of the letters. And she wrote back and sent that book, Our Way of Life. So that captain started Narcotics Anonymous in Cleveland that ran into the mid-60s. So that New York stuff went into the mid-60s. But in Cleveland, they adopted a 13th step. And what the 13th step was God help me. And it came from the Salvation Army. So we'll get back to Jimmy Kinnon's stuff. And what I believe that he was the best known for was the fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous and a worldwide fellowship. Him, Jack Prose, and Cy Malish wrote the first original brown book. It was a little brown book which turned into the white book as we know it. And what they did was they took the word drug out and they used the word addiction. And that is what sets Jimmy Kinnon aside from anybody else, because they used the word addiction, not drugs, not a substance. And as we know, addiction is the disease, and the way we think, the way we act, and the way we react to situations. And that is what makes addiction, you know, obsessive compulsive behavior. So the Schreier's Dryer meeting exploded in California. Exploded, and then what happened was a personal friend of mine, a guy named Roy Porter, I'm using last names because these people died. He had a father who was a doctor that lived in the San Fernando Valley in California, and his mother was from Philadelphia, and she lived in the Frankfurt section. And the mother and father got divorced, so he would fight with the mom and fly out and stay with the dad. And the dad happened to be a using addict. He would use his own samples and everything and get high. And then, you know, he would fight with the dad and then he would come back. But he turned into a speed freak. And he was like this 19-year-old speed freak. And he went to California and he was real bad on speed. And his dad had a friend named Bobby. And Bobby played a piano, a jazz piano. And he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he said, look, I think I could help your son. So they got him into an asylum. There was no rehabs at this time. This was 1968 in Santa Monica, California. And when he got out, Bobby was hanging out and taking the AA meetings with him. So he took him to this AA convention in California. And in one of the back rooms was Jimmy Kinnon with some other people. Since Jimmy Kinnon was from Philadelphia and Roy was from Philadelphia, he took Roy under his wings and gave him some white books and told him to go back to Philadelphia and start Narcotics Anonymous meetings. So Roy came back to Philadelphia and he wanted to start Narcotics Anonymous meetings. And this guy named Dick Flanagan, who was involved in starting an AA group called Young Men's. It was on Tarsdale Avenue, the 6500 block of Tarsdale Avenue, which is by Tarsdale and Benner. And that meeting, what they would do, this was like a hardcore AA meeting. They would handcuff you to the radiator and tell them that you're detoxing and you're going to stay sober no matter what. That's a true story, too. So what happened was when you got 90 days, they had this wall of fame, and you were allowed to put your name on the wall once you got 90 days. Well, Roy put his name on there, and they X'd it out, and they wrote drug addict and scumbag and stuff like that. So Roy went and crossed that shit back out. But what happened was Dick Flanagan worked at a hospital. It was an old TB hospital. In 1968, it switched over to help alcoholics. So Dick said, I got an idea. Why don't you come with me to my work, and we'll talk to the head doctor, who was Dr. Ottenberg, and we'll see if we can get a Narcotics Anonymous meeting started there. So he went, and Roy's all, you know, all crazy about Narcotics Anonymous. This is going to work, man. So he goes in, and he said, look, Dr. Ottenberg, my name's Roy. You know, I'm a meth addict, and you got to remember, this is a 19-year-old kid. And he goes, we're going to start Narcotics Anonymous in here. You're going to be able to let everybody go. We won't need no counselors or therapists no more, because Narcotics Anonymous is going to save everybody's life. The doctor's like, what? You better get him out of here. So then he left. He pretty much threw him out of there. And Dick said, look, you got to calm down, Roy. You know, we know you're a meth freak and all, but you got to calm down. I'm going to get you a second interview. So Roy went back on a second interview and said, look, we just want to have a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. And he started it in June of 1969, the summer of 1969. And Roy obviously made some money because, you know, the daddy was a doctor, and he opened up an elevator business and made some money. Well, he got a white book, and that white book was the 1966 version, and you could check that out, Miracles Happen. And what happened was there was five guys that went through the rehab in, like, 71. And one of the guys is in the room tonight, which is Dutch, and he got a whole – stand up, Dutch. There he is, man. Dutch is clean since December 30th, 1992, and he was in that rehab and got one of them. 72, I'm sorry, 72. Trying to steal 20 years off of him. Trying to make you youthful so you can hit the ball better. I'm sorry, 72. And I got 5 minutes? Is that what that means? I got 5 minutes. That sucks. I'm just getting into this, man. I could do this for 5 hours, believe me. Anyway, I want to say this. Dick left there and got involved in running a place up in Williamsport. It was called White Deer Run. And a couple meetings started off of that. But what Dick would do is he wanted to make sure the attics was clean. He was taking urines on them. And people said that that violated traditions. And they voted those two meetings off of the meeting list. And I want to say this. In 1976, Philadelphia was the second largest region in the world. We had 16 meetings. We were tied with Australia. And California had 83 meetings. And it was people like Dutch and Roy and Jimmy H., and several other people who went around and started a bunch of Narcotics Anonymous meeting. And then what happened was there was a guy in Georgia named Bo. He wanted to know why there wasn't a book written for Narcotics Anonymous, because what people were doing, they were crossing out the word alcohol in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, because all we had was we had five pamphlets and these white books. And what happened was he flew to San Francisco to the 7th World Convention in 1977. And he went in and he said, well, you know, who's in charge here? And Jimmy would say, oh, it was Greg. And Greg would say, no, it's Bob B. And Bob B. would say, no, it's Jimmy, because nobody was in charge. So what happened with that is my man George is going to take over from here, and he's going to tell you what happened from there. So thanks for listening.
Thank you, Danny. Our next speaker, also from the Bucks County area, is George.
I'm George. I'm an addict. I'd like to read this before I speak. God grant us knowledge that we may write according to your divine precepts. Instill in us a sense of your purpose. Make us servants of your will and grant us a bond of selflessness, that this may truly be your work, not ours, in order that no addict anywhere need die from the horrors of addiction. In all the literature committee meetings and conferences that I attended, that was how we started our work. And when we read that, like, we became selfless servants. Real quick, how I got involved with the writing of the basic text. In my area, like Danny said, we had there was a few meetings. I'm from Bucks County. At the time, I think there were three meetings in Lower Bucks anyway. I think there might have been one in Upper Bucks, but Bucks County takes over an hour to drive from one end to the other. So, but anyway, we had a step meeting. I still don't know what the steps were other than, like, we read them, you know, and then I figured out how I worked them by, you know, like, my imagination, because we didn't have sponsors in my area there. There might have been in the Philadelphia area people were doing that, but where I was from, that wasn't, you know, people would say sponsorship, and I thought, would that mean like a Big Brother-type program? And I had a couple years clean at this point, so obviously I didn't need a sponsor. But for whatever reason, somebody decided to start a step meeting, and we were using the AA 12 and 12, and we had crossed out alcoholics, and we wrote narcotics, and then it was anonymous, and we changed all the, alcohol to drugs. And we were using that, and that was our NA book. And actually, we had a couple that we transformed, and we were very proud of our work. And then we got word... This was prior to the East Coast Convention, so it would be early 1980. We had a regional meeting for the East Coast, and Bob P. from Pittsburgh had went out to the World Service Conference, and he had relayed to our region that we were violating traditions using the AA textbooks. And we looked at him and we said, what's wrong with that? It doesn't say alcohol, you know, and they explained it was a tradition violation. And then they said we could use NA literature. And our next response was, what's that? Now, I want to tell you real quick, the area that I'm from, when I got clean, I got clean February 27th, 1977. I was 17 years old. We had... Our area consisted of addicts from the age of 15 to 22, and we were running the show, fearless. They said we could only use NA literature, and we were like, what's that, dude? You know, and he said, well, any literature that an NA member or anything that an NA member writes can be used in in an NA meeting. So I was actually the public relations chair. I brought this. This was one of our works of art from 1980. These went in drugstores. It went to area service, and there were drugs that weren't, so we had to add some in area service so that no one would feel left out. Everyone said when he said that we could write the literature. My whole group that I was with, we were like, "All right, we'll write the NA steps then." And like I was like, "Well, wait a minute, like what about public relations?" You know, but they were determined that that's what we were going to do was write the NA steps. And Bob said, "Well, if that's what you guys are going to do, then I want you to call this guy. There's a world literature chair who's he lives in Atlanta, Georgia. His name's Bo." And he's writing the NA Big Book, and so that's what we called him. It was called that up until the Gray Book came out. We actually, if you see any of the pictures, we even have a cake at one of the conferences. The NA Big Book is what's on the cake. Come help us! Oh, that was the flyers. Come help us write the NA Big Book. We were having our meetings. What we did is we would have meetings on the steps. And then somebody would transcribe them on paper, and then we would use that in our meetings. And at one of the meetings, somebody said, maybe we should call this guy Bo, because Bob's met, call him. He'll want to hear. Call him. So about 2 weeks before the first East Coast Convention, we decided to call him. And everyone was afraid to call him because he was from the world. And, we were kids. And so I had the most clean time. And we were at Kenny's house, and Kenny said, look, it's my house. I'll dial. You talk. So I asked for Boo. When I told him what we were doing, I told him we were writing the NA steps in Bristol, Pennsylvania. They were in Atlanta, Georgia at the Rising Sun Clubhouse, and they were having their own literature review committee. They had about 15 people there, and we had about 15 people in Bristol. Sorry, I get choked up. But the goosebumps that both areas had, that there was another Narcotics Anonymous group out there writing NA literature at the same time. That meant something, you know, that really meant something. We knew we were doing the right thing. He started going, hallelujah, hallelujah. And I remember telling them that I had this preacher guy on the phone or something. And they were like, and I said, he just keeps saying hallelujah, you know. And then he told me that he asked me if we were going to the East Coast. And I'm like, yeah, we're, you know, part of it. He said, well, we're going to come on up and see you all, you know. And he brought up a bunch of people from down there. And that was like my first real glimpse of meeting people outside my immediate area. And it was different. You know, they had more meetings than us. They were a little more structured. They had a clubhouse, man. That was like, that was unbelievable. But anyway, yeah, from there, I met him. We talked, me and him, and he gave me the literature review like guide on how to form a committee, and he told me to use that and we'll start working together. And he let me know about the conference that was coming up, and we had a convention, a world convention in Wichita, and then Lincoln we had a literature conference, and he asked me to, you know, if I could make it. And like, we were broke, man. You know, none of us, like, it looked like nobody was going to go. And finally, I sold my washer and dryer, and I took a train out there. I had $70 in my pocket for the 11 days that I was out there. And they told me just to show up, don't worry about a place to sleep, and don't worry about food. And I was 20 years old, and that was, like, my first, you know, adventure. I showed up and they provided, it was pretty cool. And then it became like, it was nice to be a part of it. I went to the World Convention. I don't know if there was 300 people there. It was amazing how many people were there at the East Coast. We had almost 200, like that, you know, we cried the whole East Coast convention the whole time that there was actually 200 other addicts, like in this whole, you know, like quite a few states that were all clean together. Like, can you believe it? You know, like, what? Probably more here in this room or close to it. And it was really unreal. But that's, you just hugged everybody and cried. It was unbelievable that there's other people recovering just like we were in our own little areas. There was no internet, no cell phone, no, you know, so we really didn't know about it, these other areas. When we went to Lincoln, I'll speed it up. Lincoln, they had a couple boxes of Foot Lockers of all the stuff that had been sent into the World Service that was just stored. Nobody, like somebody that was in prison for life would write a letter, and somebody that their loved one died, you know, whatever it was, on the steps, and there was just all this literature just on all different kinds of paper. And what we did is we actually we used a little white book and we made an outline. Now this is chapter 8, but you see, like, it says identification, then it's common bond, addictive behavior, patterns. And what we did is we sorted those Foot Lockers into the 10 chapters according to what we thought where it belonged. And then what we did later, after the conference, we actually, at the conference, Greg and I think Bo, and I'm not sure who else, I guess Bob was probably involved, but what they did is they did what's called the cut and paste. And if nobody saw cut and paste, what we did is we used the outline, and then the stuff that was sorted into it, we would read the outline and say, well, does anybody have a sentence or paragraph out of the literature that's in front of them that would start this part of the outline? And then what they would do is they would cut it out and paste it on here, and then somebody else would go, oh, I got something that fits right into that, and we cut that out. And as you can see, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. There's 6 different types of writings on this. Then it'd be copied, and then this would get typed up. But using this process in Lincoln, we the first 7 pages, I think, were initially started. And then what happened after that was after the conference was over, each individual areas started doing the cut and paste on separate chapters. Now, I was working, I was part of Bristol Lit Committee, and we got Chapter 8, but I also, I used to make meetings in Philadelphia, and they had asked me in the Northeast if we could move our meeting to Philadelphia. Well, you know, we were Bristol Lit, and we were pretty proud of being Bristol Lit. You know, so we asked them to come to our meeting. Well, public transportation didn't deliver them to there. So then their next solution was they asked me to start a meeting for them in the Northeast, and I told them they could start it themselves. But the real deal was, like, I was the only person from Pennsylvania that attended this conference. There was no one with experience. And they said, we want you there. You know what's going on. What I then assumed that Philadelphia would want to work on Chapter 8, you know, Bristol Tuesday and Philadelphia, you know. And they looked at me and they go, we don't get our own chapter? And so then I called Bo up, and Bo sent me Chapter 10. And so Bristol worked on Chapter 8 and Philadelphia worked on Chapter 10. On the cut and paste thing, you know, when we were done with that, it went through, you know, four or five conferences, editing, you know, but like that was the initial start of putting it together, actually for the Gray Book, you know, but anyway, after both committees completed their chapters, and then we went to Memphis. Memphis was the next conference, and in Memphis, the chapters that were already cut and paste, they started going through the edit and review process. And we had a blackboard that had the different processes, and it talked about it had all 10 chapters, and it marked X's on where across the, you know, the board they were, and that's how you could look and you could see where each chapter was, and you know, it would go editing, typed up, review. And one of the things that I found surprising in one of the review, like the final reviews, Bo had kids, not kids, but people from newcomers from the rehab reading the literature. And I go, Bo, what the hell is going on? These people were reviewing the literature? They got like not even 30 days. And he goes, who do you think we're writing the literature for? And he said, if they don't understand it, then we failed, haven't we? And, you know, so every one of them, you know, I didn't understand it. Didn't, you know, the guys with a lot of time should have been reading it. But, you know, he was right. And every one of them said they felt like the literature was talking to them. You know, so we kind of felt like we were on track with it. From there, after Memphis, we spent a lot of time on the reviews. And all during this process, some people had asked me about the stories. When did the stories come in? The stories were always part of it because they're part of the little white book, and that's what the basic text was based off. We took the little white book and we blew the chapters up. There's stories in there, and that's how. But we concentrated on the first 10 chapters because the stories we put out, send stories, and at every conference there's people on the phone typing stories where people were calling in from all over the country and all over the world, you know, so that they could be considered, you know, to be put in the basic text. I went out to Santa Monica. That was, I remember, it's got real serious out in Santa Monica. One, the World Service Conference was being held simultaneously to the Literature Conference. And Bo actually allowed me to chair one of the conference meetings. And we spent about 2.5 hours debating whether the word chronic should be put in the basic text or not. And they were reading the definition of the word chronic. It, you know, people really took it. It came down to like a single word. We spent hours. Does that actually go in there? And people would debate back and forth. And, you know, and it's hard for everyone to agree. We agreed to, I think, to table it is basically what we wound up, you know, we passed the buck on. But it was, it got really tough, you know. The final conference that I was a part of, and also in our area, when I went out to Santa Monica, I was also the regional rep for this area. It was actually part of my own home groups or region, I guess area, region, whatever. But Mid-Atlantic hadn't formed yet. And when I went out in 81, I represented like New York, New Jersey, I think Connecticut, I think Maine might have been at our regional, Virginia, Maryland, Delaware, West Virginia. Larry North, who Danny mentioned, he was actually my alternate, and we went out together. The final conference that I attended was the one that was held in Philadelphia, and it was actually at Ivyland in Bucks County, and it was on the stories. And basically, you know, most of the people were writing their stories there. I was not, I was reluctant to write my story, and the reason for it was Greg Pierce was my first sponsor, and his story was in the little white book. One of the things that he said to me was that he lost his personal anonymity, because I said, that's really cool, your story's in there. And he's like, yeah, he said, you would think, but he says, everybody thinks I represent Narcotics Anonymous. And when I go into a meeting, people appoint, you know, that's the guy, that's his stories, you know. And he said, so I think twice about taking the responsibility. And I looked at him, I said, dude, like, there's no way, you know. I did wind up submitting my story. At that conference, I had almost 5 years clean, four and a half, I think. You know, I got clean as a teenager. That was not, you know, they didn't have that. And that's how the stories were submitted. We had different categories. You know, we had color, we had nationality, countries, old, young, professional, derelict, you know. And when we, basically the idea behind the stories was that anybody could open the book, read a story, and no matter who they were, they would find something to identify with. Might not identify with every story, but you would find a story that you could identify with and go, that's me, you know. And I don't know, as far as you know, it's cool to be here, you know, today, and I know Dutch and, you know, many of us that have been around, to see the growth, unbelievable. You know, I always figured in my mind that I didn't know anybody that just drank. You know, so I couldn't figure out how, you know, someday we have to have more meetings because there's more people that have, you know, nobody just drinks anymore, at least nobody I knew growing up, you know. I'll leave with the, I want to tell you the first meeting I went to. First meeting I went to was at outpatient rehab that I was in. I had probably 2 weeks clean, and it was my very first meeting. The guy that took me there, he was in an advanced group, and I wasn't allowed to go. I wasn't allowed to speak at the rehab. I hallucinated my first 40 days clean, and pretty much if you were talking, I'd cut you off and I'd give you a better story. And they told me that if I ever said another word, I'd get kicked out. So I didn't say anything. And the meeting was there, and it was a round robin. There was 12, 14 people, and they all went around, and at the end, you know, they looked at me and they said, do you want to share? And I looked and I'm like, me? And then I thought it was a setup, you know. And I told them I wasn't allowed. They all laughed, you know, that was cute. And I said, no, this isn't the rehab. You know, this is Narcotics Anonymous. I didn't know what Narcotics Anonymous, so I had no idea what they were talking about. They could have said a different language. I wouldn't understand any worse. And finally they convinced me to share, and I'm like, you know, I go, you know, well, these people, you know, and I, you know, started letting them know all the crazy shit that was going on, and I was unloading, really getting in my groove, and they said, George, we're out of time, thanks for sharing, keep coming back. And after the meeting, they lined up and gave me hugs, and they gave me their phone numbers and told me to call. And now today I understand they understood me, you know. But what I thought back then, man, I really gave them some good shit. You know, I need to come back here. So I have. Thanks. Yeah.